DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn, Germany. Let us celebrate food. I promise that will be the last or one of the last of the fruit and veg puns. On the show, can obesity-induced inflammation reduce your ability to taste? How much CO2 does one sandwich produce? You'll be surprised. And turnip up with today's secret sound. Any ideas? Stay tuned to get yourself out of that pickle. All that and more on this jam-packed food edition of Spectrum. There's a science to creating the perfect sarnie, sanger or sandwich, from selecting your favourite bread to meats, cheeses and sauces. But have you ever thought about where all the ingredients in your sandwich come from? How far they've travelled, what it took to get them to your kitchen counter? And have you ever gone as far as thinking about which sandwich filling has the worst carbon footprint? Well, researchers at the University of Manchester studied 20 of the top-selling sandwiches in the UK to work out which fillings are the worst offenders. No prizes for guessing that the full English breakfast containing bacon, sausage and egg generated the most carbon dioxide emissions. It seems eating just one mega meat sandwich is as poisonous for the planet as driving an average car for 19 kilometres or 12 miles. Nick Martin spoke to some Brits here in Bonn to see how far they would change their eating habits to save the planet.
Cheese and pickle, ham and coleslaw.
Whenever she flies back to her native Britain, Wysam Cheng has developed a routine that involves the humble sandwich.
Well, it's one of the first things I do when I land at Gatwick Airport. I rush into the Marks and Spencers and buy myself a sandwich for my train journey.
Originally from Portsmouth in England, she now lives near Bonn in Western Germany with her husband Sven and four-year-old son Dylan. And while she's got used to lunches of bratwurst and meatballs, she often hankers after tastes from home.
There's just so much variety in the fillings in the UK. You know, you have the chicken tikka, you might have your prawn cocktail, you might have your BLTs. Maybe they might have more Japanese twist to it, like a chicken teriyaki baguette. I guess maybe for a foreigner, they might think that's a funny combination to have in bread. But I think the UK just love it.
There we go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Who's waiting to order?
Britain's love affair with sandwiches was the focus of a recent study by researchers at the University of Manchester, who estimated that the 11.5 billion so-called sarnies eaten in the UK every year are the equivalent to having 8.6 million extra cars on the road. And though it's unsurprising that fillings of mainly processed meat had the highest carbon footprint, one of the study's authors, Adisa Azapagic, said sandwiches stuffed with dairy products also fared quite badly.
One of the surprises perhaps would have been sandwiches which have cheese. Perhaps you wouldn't expect a higher carbon footprint with such sandwiches. But in fact, it turns out that dairy products have a high carbon footprint. And that is because of the cows which burp methane, and methane is a potent greenhouse gas.
Ham and cheese sandwiches fared poorly, along with prawn and mayonnaise. But while most vegetables are less bad for the planet, Professor Azapagic says it still depends how they're grown.
The use of tomato and lettuce can increase the carbon footprint of sandwiches. That is because lettuce and tomato are grown in greenhouses, and the greenhouses are heated and they need energy. So just by either changing the cultivation practices for tomato and lettuce, growing them in the open, or by reducing the amount of ingredients or even not using them, you can decrease the carbon footprint of sandwiches.
Hi there, what can I get for you?
Researchers looked at the complete life cycle of sandwich making to arrive at their estimates, including the farming of the ingredients, meal creation, packaging, consumption, waste, refrigeration and transportation. They also compared the top 20 shop-bought sandwiches to their equivalent lunches made at home, to see if the increasingly industrial processes used by big retailers were helping or hindering climate change. Professor Azapagic says the difference was stark.
We have found that the homemade sandwich had half the impact on climate change compared to the commercially made sandwich. Some of the reasons for that include that at home, of course, you don't have packaging, and also the refrigeration of sandwiches is not carried out at home as it is in commercially bought sandwiches.
If the takeaway from the research is that we should buy fewer sandwiches and make our own, Cheng is concerned that the economies of countries like Britain are now built on the consumption of food outside the home.
If you have the small businesses especially that are trying to compete with the larger chains, they won't really stand a chance if people's eating habits are going to change, where they're saying, I'm going to make my food at home and bring it into work the next day, for example. I think that would suffer. So it's a tough balance.
Azapagic says a return to less intensive farming methods, more green packaging, and substituting the worst ingredients for healthier alternatives could massively reduce the environmental impact. Researchers also called for the use-by dates of supermarket sandwiches to be extended, as they are often conservative. That view is backed up by the British Sandwich Association, which estimates that at least 2,000 tons of sandwich waste could be saved annually. But in focusing on the lovable British sarnie, the carbon footprint of fast food chains, a sector that's growing in the UK by 8% a year and is arguably much worse for the environment, remains ignored.
Nick Martin with that report. Pedro Meteor from Mexico has written into us here at the Science Desk with a question. He wants to know, what's the difference between fruit and vegetables? Emma Wallace is here with the answer. Emma, over to you.
Well, there's a botanical answer. Vegetables are plants with leaves and roots. But fruit always grows from blossoms, except that zucchini blossoms don't produce any fruit. Or do they? It can be confusing. Biology is usually viewed as an orderly science. Fish are vertebrates that live in water and have gills. Birds are vertebrates that have feathers and wings. And mammals are vertebrates covered in hair. But try to differentiate between a fruit and a vegetable, and even scientists can get a little confused. It doesn't help to judge the matter based on sugar content either. Take carrots, for example. They can be really sweet, but they're still considered a vegetable. The bottom line is that society decides what it considers to be a fruit or a vegetable. Botanical experts use other criteria. They call annual plants that have to be sown anew each year vegetables, whereas fruit grows on perennial trees or shrubs, which live for many years. An apple tree can live for a century or even longer. But even here, there are exceptions, like asparagus, a perennial vegetable. No matter what you choose to call them, in the end, it's the flavour that matters.
If you've got a question you'd like us to answer at the Science Desk, get in contact with us via email science@dw.com. Twitter @DW_SciTech, Facebook DW Science, or you can always write to me on Twitter @JessieWingard. Close to 2 billion adults worldwide are overweight. Just ponder that for a moment. The World Health Organization reports that obesity has tripled globally since 1975 and today kills more people than malnutrition. But what is obesity really doing to our bodies? Dr. Robin Dando, Assistant Professor in the Department of Food Science at Cornell University, along with a group of researchers, took a look at how obesity in mice can bring about a reduced sense of taste. Joining me on the line from the United States is Dr. Dando. Dr. Dando, welcome to Spectrum. Perhaps we should start with the obvious question. How does our sense of taste actually work?
We have these tiny organs called taste buds. We have maybe about 10,000 of them in our mouths. They're collections of about 100 cells, and some of those cells are sensitive to sweet stimuli, some of them to salty, to sour, to bitter, or to a savory taste that we call umami, that people are getting a little bit more familiar with, but is still the one that people will have the most questions about. So when we put food into our mouths, it will, if it has anything that is sweet, bitter, salty, sour, umami, it will activate one of these cells and send a signal to your brain. People tend to sometimes confuse what is taste with what is kind of flavor, let's say, where something in the mouth, we can also smell it at the same time. And so therefore, a lot of the more characteristic flavors of foods are actually things that we're smelling while the food's in our mouth.
Do taste buds have the ability to regenerate, or do we have them for life?
So taste buds can be thought of in some senses like hazard sensor. They're there to, as well as to give us the appreciation of foods that we love to eat, they're there to detect if something is dangerous in the environment. So for this to really work well, you can think about the bumper on the front of your car. It can't be irreplaceable. It has to be something that's easy and cheap to replace in case there is something damaging that we put into our mouths thinking it's food and it's actually not. So our taste buds are constantly turning over, which means that new cells are being born inside that taste bud all the time, and old cells are being broken down and recycled.
Now, your initial research has been looking at mice and how a state of obesity affected their taste buds. Talk me through that process.
Sure. So we have a colony of mice. We study mice because the taste buds are put together pretty similarly to human taste buds. And when a new litter of mice is born, we would take half of that litter, put them in one cage, and half of the litter and put them in another cage. The first cage gets a healthy diet that's kind of like, you can think of it like dry dog food. The mice like it. They stay healthy for a long time and live a long and happy life. On the other cage, we have a chow that is made from a very high fat content. So that means that the mice still really love to eat it, but they grow up being very fat. So after a certain amount of time in our study, 8 weeks, we then look at the mice and see how they've put on weight and how their taste buds have changed.
What were you able to see in the mice?
Well, in our high-fat diet-fed mice, we saw that they'd started to lose taste buds. We would assume that they started with the same number, them being, you know, just standard lab mice and being siblings to the control mice. But the ones that had been on the high-fat diet had about 25% less taste buds than the ones that had been on the healthy diet. So in order to study if this was an effect of the diet or an effect of being obese, we also used a genetically engineered mouse line, which is able to eat that high-fat diet but doesn't get fat. Those mice ate the same amount of the diet but didn't get fat, and their taste buds look fine, which suggests that whatever is happening to taste buds is dependent not on what foods you're eating but on the process of becoming obese.
How do you think your findings will correlate to human taste buds?
Well, there are a few studies out there that suggest that humans who are obese experience taste slightly less intensely than humans that are lean. And we also ran a study a couple of years ago where we tracked a human population and looked at weight gain in that population. And it seemed like, at least in the males in the population, the ones that gained weight seemed to lose taste function too.
Do you think people that are losing that sense of taste, are they more likely to consume more calories?
We would predict so. When we're eating food, we're eating it for the nutritional properties of the food, of course, but as well as that, we're eating it to get a positive feeling from food. We tend to eat the foods that we like. When there's less input coming from your taste buds to the brain, that means you're likely getting less pleasure from the food, less satisfaction from the food, so maybe drawn towards consuming more of it. We tested that out in a separate study a year or so ago where we took humans and blocked their taste function with a chemical that can just make sweet taste not taste very sweet, and got them to rate their enjoyment of foods and also kind of make their own foods. And the ones who had a weakened taste function tended to gravitate towards the higher calorie stimuli, meaning that they're eating more calories and so therefore putting themselves in danger of becoming more obese.
Can the effects of this taste loss be reversed in people who went on to lose a considerable amount of weight?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't have a very satisfying answer for you, unfortunately, but that's something that we're looking into at the moment. I would predict that it would be possible to bring that taste function back, because taste buds do have this capacity to regenerate. They seem to be quite hardy, but it's likely to take a long time. And that might be a clue as to why people have such a difficult time sticking to diets. If it takes a long time before you get that taste function back, then you might just give up and go back to old habits.
And I'm certainly one of those people. Where's your research headed now?
As you mentioned, we're very interested in this possibility of either bringing that taste function back or finding a way to protect it from ever going away to begin with. So I think that's an interesting area to look at.
Dr. Robin Dando, Assistant Professor in the Department of Food Science at Cornell University, thank you for joining me on the program today to talk about how obesity in mice can bring about a reduced sense of taste. And there's that mystery sound again. Any ideas? Stay tuned to crack the case. But first, Germany is known as a land of innovation, especially when it comes to the energy sector. Well, now there's a new invention on the scene. Researchers in the south of the country are harnessing the power of the sun to keep milk cold. The company has created an efficient milk cooling unit that relies on solar energy. The project is being tested in Tunisia and Kenya, where small dairy farmers don't always have access to refrigerating systems to store their milk or for keeping it cool during transport. Gerlin Fomer went to find out more, and her report is presented by Natalie Muller.
It's a sunny day in the southern German town of Memmingen. And just as well, Dirk Gutzeit is about to give a demonstration of the special solar device that he helped design. The engineer has just dragged his equipment out to Faizan's company car park. He hitches up the white refrigeration system to a strategically placed solar module, and the magic begins. The sun's rays are beating down, perfect conditions for making ice, with energy from the sun. The solar-powered freezer can produce 6 to 8 kilograms of ice at a time, enough to keep 30 litres of milk cool for 12 hours. Gutzeit opens the unit and carefully removes a couple of large cylinders of ice, frozen solid, then slides them into a custom-built compartment inside an insulated milk can. The whole contraption works as an environmentally friendly cooling system that keeps milk from going bad, Gutzeit explains.
You don't have any more milk going off, and that means up to 30% bigger deliveries to dairies. So the system will pay for itself within 2 or 2.5 years.
The price tag for the equipment is 3,000 euros, or just under $3,500. It's conceived of, above all, for use in places like rural Africa that lack reliable connections to the electricity grid. In terms of Germany, that amount is a mere fraction of the cost of automatic milking systems typically used here, where raw milk is sent directly to massive refrigerated storage tanks, not transported in small canisters. Still, the company wanted to test their product on local farmers, so they've come here to visit Josef Friedel. The organic dairy farmer, clad in green overalls and a green cap, has agreed to give the milk cooling can a go.
Die Milch, die wir gemolken haben.
Our milk goes straight into the tank and is cooled there. In other countries, it goes in here.
He points to the company's metal canister, which he fills with fresh milk from his cows. Then he opens slots in the special compartment for the ice and fills them with three large blocks from the solar-powered freezer. Friedel isn't used to this kind of time-consuming and back-breaking way of working. His farm is equipped with a lot of labour-reducing devices, but the farmer says he could appreciate how the cooling can could work for a smallholder in Africa.
The technology is very simple, so there's not a lot that can go wrong. In Germany, we usually have a lot of technology, so a lot can go wrong. And this can hold quite a bit. 30 litres is a fair amount.
Intensive industrial-style farming in Germany means milk output is relatively high, but in Africa, one cow produces just 5 litres of milk a day, so the 30-litre can would be big enough for a small herd of cattle. Not only does the invention use renewable energy to prevent food waste, it could also help reduce bacterial growth in milk that has to be stored or transported. This makes the milk healthy and safer for human consumption. So, how well does it work? Friedel sticks a thermometer into the raw milk. After 10 minutes, the 3 6-kilo blocks of ice have cooled down the milk considerably.
It's 28 degrees now. A 10-degree reduction in heat is a lot for such a short time.
That's good news for Tobias Schwerner. He's the managing director of Faizan, which developed the system in cooperation with the University of Hohenheim, just outside of Stuttgart in Germany.
Up to now, our goal has been to help smallholders with 2 to 3 cows in tropical and subtropical regions, because they have the greatest need to cool their milk right after milking.
The first pilot trials are taking place in Sidi Bouzid in Tunisia. 10 dairies there have been equipped with off-grid solar modules and refrigerator boxes, which were produced in southern Germany. The project is being funded with German development aid. Here's Schwerner again.
We're already conducting a second pilot trial in Kenya, which has a slightly different focus. And we're working on the commercial side of things. We've put together a set, which has an article number and can be ordered via Faizan.
In parts of rural Kenya, milk is often handled by small-scale farmers that organise themselves into cooperatives. Bikes and motorbikes are used to transport the milk from the farm to collecting points, where it's bulked for wholesale. The Faizan engineers haven't actually seen firsthand how their cooling system is being used in Kenya yet, but they do get sent updates and photos from time to time.
Look, Dirk, we've got the latest photos from the milk cooling system in Kenya.
He cycles to the cow.
Right.
The team hope to refine their cooling equipment based on the outcome of further tests. But in the meantime, more prototypes from the company's offices in southern Germany are on their way to Africa. Now, that transport just needs to be made carbon neutral to also benefit the environment.
Natalie Muller presenting that report by Gelin Foma. And there's that secret sound again, and it's finally time to find out what it is. Any ideas? What if I said carrot, leek, celery, pumpkin, or onion? I know, you've got a weird look on your face as I say that, but bear with me. In the city of Mozart and Strauss, it's not surprising that orchestras are still drawing big crowds. But what about a biodegradable ensemble that composes its own hip-hop organic sounds and is cultivating new fans across the world? That's right, it's Vienna's Vegetable Orchestra. Although their handcrafted instruments are boiled down and eaten after each performance, the group is celebrating 20 years of surprises and reinventions. DW's Christian Cummins went to rehearsal to check it out.
A violin improvised from two leeks, a flute made by drilling into a cucumber, a sort of trumpet carved from a pumpkin. These are just some of the instruments that the members of Vienna's cult Vegetable Orchestra are carefully working into shape around a table in the city's 4th district, blowing into the instruments to test the sounds, and then carving and drilling some more to improve the tone. So, are vegetables natural wonders of musicality? Here's founding member Matthias Meinhartner.
Actually, it's a very bad material to make music out of. It's actually a challenge to make music, and that's, I think, the main idea, to make music on something that's challenging you to do music on.
It's a challenge of adaptability and of innovation. That takes patience and a love of the absurd, as well as a love of, let's say, unusual sounds.
I can take the leek violin, which is actually, for me, a very, as a, from the sound, it's very vegetable, I would say. And also the kind of playing is, for me, very unique, because you take two leeks. The one is the body, and the other leek is the bow. And then you rub it against each other. And these, let's say, the strings inside the structure of the leek, they're kind of making a squeaking noise, like a torture rat or so. It's like... And this is a sound that's... It's hard to play also because it's not working always. So, yeah, I think it's very vegetable.
Susanna Gartmeier, who has a background in the fine arts and plays a regular bass clarinet in her spare time, has been performing with the Vegetable Orchestra for 12 years now. And she says it's a constantly evolving process.
I don't know how many instruments we invented during the time, really lots. And it's also the fact that everyone specialized in some instruments, and there are many schools of building instruments. So some people think the flute has to be built like that, and other people have another school of building the flute. And yeah, so it's a constant process actually to invent new ways of playing vegetables.
A Stradivarius violin can become a valuable family heirloom, but the life cycle of a vegetable instrument is as short as that of a mayfly. The day of the concert begins in the outside market, a dash to the iconic Naschmarkt in central Vienna, for example, looking for fresh vegetables to create sounds.
It's like cooking, actually. Yeah, you buy something, you buy the vegetables, then you prepare them for, let's say, then the soup, and then the end you eat the soup. And the same process is actually with our concert.
That means new vegetables are bought every morning, shaped in the afternoon, and then used to perform on stage. At the end of the process, the vegetables are literally boiled up into a soup that's served to the audience after the concert, giving fans a fully immersive experience.
Yeah, the audience get to see the music, they get to hear the music, of course, they get also to smell the music, and at the end they get to taste the music too.
Despite a few variations on well-known Kraftwerk tunes, the Vegetable Orchestra is no cover band. They write their own innovative music that involves dark, mysterious underground sounds that fit Vienna's new incarnation as one of the world's capitals of electro sounds.
I think one of the few common interests, the aesthetic interests of all the members, is interest in electronic music and also the history of electronic music, all the things that happened. So that's also what you can find in our pieces.
The music is written in an experimental, collaborative way.
One person has an idea and brings some material, and then we try it out together, and then this person rearranges the stuff.
As the orchestra celebrates its 20th birthday, Matthias believes the members have come on a long journey together.
Of course, before, when we've started 20 years ago, it was more, let's say, a student project. At the time now, I think we are more an ensemble. All of us get a musical training. We have like rhythm training, and the music gets, I think, much better.
And despite their longevity, the Vegetable Orchestra still manages to surprise its audiences, which is one of the reasons Susanna Gartmeier remains so committed to this juicy ensemble.
It has been very many times a very nice experience for me that people come with an expectation to go into a kind of a cabaret, and then they realize that it's really meant totally seriously. And after the performance, quite often when we give the soup to the audience, we talk with them, and I really often get this feedback that they think, you opened something up in my head.
Vienna's Vegetable Orchestra, breaking the boundaries of music, then celebrating it with a broth for one of the healthiest nights out you could possibly imagine. Christian Cummins for DW.
I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
A healthy night out indeed. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Spectrum. I'm sure we've made you a little bit hungry in the meantime. We'll be back next week with another packed edition of the show. Meanwhile, to keep up to date with all things happening in the science and technology world, you can check us out on Twitter at DW_SciTech, or on Facebook, DW Science, and we're also online, dw.com/science. I'm Jessie Wingard. On Twitter, you can find me at Jessie Wingard, and I'd love to hear from you. From all of us here at DW, have a wonderful and healthy week ahead.
I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so impressed.